You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Well, 4 weeks ago, one morning, I had just gotten to the coffee shop, sat down, opened up my computer to do a little bit of writing that day, when I got a call from my really good friend. This was probably the worst call I had ever received. My buddy and his wife were 7.5 months pregnant. They were pregnant with their very first child, a little girl. She was to be due on the exact same day as my little girl, my firstborn, who's coming here in less than 2 weeks. And he was calling to tell me that in the middle of the night, his little baby girl's heart stopped beating. Devastating news. And in a little while, he and his wife were going to go to the hospital and they were going to deliver their girl, stillborn. Now, those of you that are moms, those of you that are dads, you're well aware. Pregnancy is a hard and a long process, right? There's this long sense of waiting, a really long period of waiting and anticipation, and it takes a toll on you. It takes a toll on you mentally and physically, emotionally, spiritually. I mean, certainly on the woman, on her body, it just, your body starts changing and it's hard. It's a process. And then the birth comes, and that's a really painful and hard thing for the woman to endure. But none of that matters when you hold your child in your arms, right? For my wife and I, it could be any day now, right? And for all that my wife has had to go through, she's had to put up with me, her body has been taking a toll. And no matter how hard our birth and our pregnancy is going to be, it's not going to matter when I hold my daughter in my hands. And so for my friends to have to go through this process where they go through the whole thing, all the waiting, it takes such a toll on them in all those ways. It takes a toll on her body that goes through the entire birth process, all the pain that she had to go through, only to hold their child lifeless in their hands. It was devastating. A few days after that, my wife and I drove up to go be with our friends, to be with them during their grief, to attend the funeral service of their little girl. And I will never forget that day. I will never forget that funeral service. In the midst of such pain and suffering and devastation, I will never forget the response of hope and peace and joy that I experienced and that I saw from my friends. As all these friends and family gathered around on this day, came to show their support, to lend their love and their care, they greeted every single one of them that came in with a big smile and a huge hug, thanked them for coming. As the service went through, my buddy got up and he spoke such beautiful words of affirmation and his trust in God. He spoke words of prayer and hope over his little girl. At the end of the service, we sang all together. We sang, "'Tis so sweet to trust in Jesus." We sang, "'It is well with my soul." And I looked over at my buddy, with his head high, a smile on his face, just singing as loud as he can. Now, how is that possible? How is it possible to respond like that? In the midst of such pain and suffering and grief, just total devastation, how is it possible to respond with joy and peace and hope and trust in God? And we're going to look at a little book in the Bible, I think, that gives us some direction, that gives us some answers to that question. We're in the middle of a series in the Minor Prophets, and today we come into the book of Habakkuk. We know very little about the prophet Habakkuk. We don't actually even know for sure how to pronounce his name. Habakkuk, Habakkuk, we're not sure. But this short 3-chapter book is very contemporary. It's very relevant for us today because the situation that Habakkuk finds himself in is representative of the kinds of situations that we all find ourselves in various times in our lives. Habakkuk was a very godly man who God called to be a leader to his people. Habakkuk was a prophet, and he was supposed to be this rock-solid leader. And yet, in this book, in that first chapter that we just heard, we see him wrestling mightily with God, wrestling with these doubts that he has. In the first chapter of Habakkuk, there in verse 2, we see him crying out to God. He says, "O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you, violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me, strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted." Do you hear that in his voice? He's just crying out to God, "How long, O Lord? How long will I be surrounded by evil and destruction and injustice? The wicked are prospering at the expense of the righteous. There's evil all around, and you do nothing." Let me give you a little background into this complaint that Habakkuk is bringing to God. In the time that Habakkuk is living, the nation of Israel, it's split into two different kingdoms. They were divided. Israel was in the north, and Judah was in the south. And Habakkuk was a prophet to the kingdom of Judah in the south. And now there were quite a few bad kings in the history of Judah. They just had this line of bad kings. But King Josiah, he was an exception to this. Josiah was this godly king who ruled Judah. He ruled it really well, and God's people prospered under his reign. But just as things were sort of getting turned around, just as they were experiencing this economic, this spiritual growth and vitality, Josiah was suddenly killed. And after Josiah's death, things just went immediately downhill. Total train wreck. His sons who ruled after him were just awful, and they led Judah into much evil and idolatry. And all this good, all this progress, all this momentum that Josiah had brought about was completely undone in just a very short time. And Judah was just consumed with this chaos and evil and violence. And this is the point at which Habakkuk is writing. He's looking around at his people, his nation, that he just so longs to be prospering. And he's going, what's happening here? God, why are you letting this great nation of Judah, who you care about, who are supposed to be your set-apart people, why are you letting them turn into a mockery? Why don't you do something about this? And this is the question that we all ask God at times, isn't it? God, why is this happening? Why are there stillborn births? Why can't we seem to get pregnant? Why are there so many abortions, abandoned children? Why is there genocide? Why is there not enough clean water in the world? Why do so many people not have enough money to feed their own family? Why didn't I get that job or promotion that I've been working towards for years? Why do I have this physical condition that just ails me? Why do I have this illness? These things and so many others create doubt in our mind, and they drive us to call out to God, "Why is this happening to me?" So God responds to Habakkuk. He hears his complaints. And starting in verse 5 of chapter 1, I'm just going to summarize God's response for you. God says, "Look, I am going to do something, Habakkuk. I'm going to do something that you're not going to understand." And then God reveals to Habakkuk that the Chaldeans, also known as the Babylonians, these guys are the epitome of everything that Habakkuk, and God for that matter, just detested. Some of the most ruthless, bloodthirsty people in all of history. And these guys, God says, he's going to use them to be his instrument of judgment against Judah. That's his response to Habakkuk's complaint. And as you can imagine, this is not the answer that Habakkuk was hoping for. And so Habakkuk responds a second time. He brings a second complaint to God. And he says, "God, you can't do that. Like, you can't use the Babylonians to judge us. They're way worse than we are. Like, I know I was complaining about crying out to you about the violence and the evil and the destruction, but this can't be your answer. This doesn't make any sense. This is not a good plan at all. Habakkuk is confused, he's angry, and he's wrestling with massive doubts. Any honest pursuit of God in this world will at some point hit roadblocks of doubt. Habakkuk hits these roadblocks, but he also shows us how it is that we're to get through them. In the midst of his deep struggles, this book ends with this beautiful affirmation of faith. Listen to this real quick. At the very end, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the field yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. That's a remarkable place to end up, all the way from chapter 1. And the question that I want us to look at today is, how do we get there? In our own faith, in the midst of our own doubts, if you haven't already experienced doubts like this towards God, you will. And so how do we get through those doubts? At the end of the day, through our struggles with doubt and envy and bitterness, how do we respond like my friends did? How do we respond like Habakkuk, affirming and worshiping God for his sufficiency? How do we respond to God with unclouded devotion and worship, even in the midst of pain and suffering and doubt? And I want to answer this question by looking at two things that we see from this passage. The first one is, what's the nature of doubt? What's the nature of doubt? And then secondly, getting through our doubt. How do we then, after we've understood something about doubt, how do we get through it and respond like that? One thing that we learn from this book, we'll start with the nature of doubt. And one thing that we learn from this book about the nature of doubt is that struggles with doubt are inevitable for those who are genuinely working out their faith and working for the good of others, those around them. Like, doubt is not—it's not just this problem for weak Christians. Habakkuk, like this guy, let's just take Habakkuk. Right, he was this leader of people. He was a prophet to God's people. He was a godly dude, and yet he struggled mightily with doubts towards God. Now, I've spoken to so many of you over the past few years, and you have expressed some form of doubt to me that you're wrestling with. For some of you, it's in the middle of some pain and suffering that you're experiencing. Others, it's some questions that you're really wrestling with related to Christianity, what it means to have faith in God. And for some, it's you're just experiencing doubt because you feel distant towards God. You're going through a season of struggle, and you're just wrestling with doubts. And as I hear from so many of you during these times, I see it in your eyes, or I hear it in your voice, this question of fear. It's like, is this okay? Right? What does God think of me? And look, I want you to listen to me here. You are not a weak Christian if you wrestle with doubts towards God. Like, God isn't afraid of your doubts. They don't offend him. He doesn't condemn you for them. Do you notice how God interacts with Habakkuk here? Habakkuk cries out to God. Right? He's really bold with his complaints towards God. He doesn't mince any words. Right? But God doesn't respond with anger or with wrath or with disappointment. God listens to Habakkuk and then he answers him. Right? He says, okay, look, Habakkuk, I hear your complaint. I see your doubt. And I will answer you, but you're not going to understand or like the answer that I have. So he responds to Habakkuk. Habakkuk hears. He doesn't understand God's answer, and so he brings a second complaint to God. He's a bold guy. And God answers Habakkuk again. And this second time, God gives Habakkuk a better understanding, a bigger picture for what's going to happen through all of this. And now, mind you, this is, right, the God of the universe that Habakkuk is talking to. Right? He's all-powerful, he's all-knowing, he's all-sovereign. But he isn't offended by Habakkuk's complaints. Right? They don't anger or surprise him. And what I think this book tells us is that God wants to draw near to us in the midst of our doubt. He wants us to experience his comfort and presence. So the first thing about our doubt, about the nature of our doubt, is that it's not just for weak Christians. Our doubt is real. Second, doubt is not abstract. It's personal. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. Doubt is never purely intellectual. Right? It's always connected to what is going on in our heart. In verse 3, Habakkuk says, "Why do you make me see iniquity?" Or why do you make me look upon iniquity? You see, Habakkuk always knew about injustice. Right? He knew that it existed, but recently it hit him. It became personal and entered his world. It affected his soul. See, Habakkuk didn't take any new information in about the world around him, about the injustice going on in the world. Rather, this injustice that was already happening, it became real to him in a way that he hadn't experienced before. Our doubts are never just about what's going on in our head. It's not just about our thinking. It's also about our experience. And isn't that true of us as well? Doubts for us come when personal experience makes what our mind knows unreal to our heart. Our doubts are never just purely about being able to believe the evidence in front of us. Rather, our doubts are about not being able to believe the evidence in light of what is going on inside of us, in light of what is going on in our hearts. And so faith is not opposed to reason. Right? Faith is not holding on to something in spite of the evidence. Faith is holding on to something that you know and believe is true in spite of the appearances. This happens in dating sometimes. You all have that friend who just, she shouldn't be dating that guy, right? You all know it. She knows it. The guy's, he's headed nowhere. He's only bringing her down. Right? He's making her make compromises that she would never make. Right, and she's just, this is not her, right? And so you pull her aside, you say, "Hey, this guy is not right for you. He's bringing you down, he's making you do things you would never do, he's making you make compromises. This is just not you. You're not the same person that you were. You should not be in this relationship. This is not good for you." And she says, "You know what, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. This guy's, he's not good for me. I knew that from the beginning. I've sort of always have known that," right? And she gets this moment of clarity, this conviction. She's like, I just need to break up with this guy. But you've all seen it, right? When she gets with that guy, when she's in his presence, when she experiences that context of being in the relationship, all of a sudden, she's not so sure about that conviction anymore, is she? What's going on there? Has she gotten any new information about that guy? Has she learned anything new about who he is? No. No, her personal experience of being with this guy, being in his presence, is speaking louder to her than what she knows to be true. Her personal experience is making what her mind knows unreal to her heart. And those are the moments when doubt begins to creep into our lives. Let me give you another example. Most of you have probably, you've come face to face with extreme poverty at some point in your life, I would guess, either here in the United States or maybe in a third world country. For those of you that have gone to Guatemala, you've been to our partnership there in the village of Pueblo Modelo, you're aware of this. All right, and even the most rock solid, unshakable in my faith and who God is and his goodness, when you drive in that bus into the village of Pueblo Modelo and you experience firsthand the poverty, when you experience firsthand the malnutrition, you see streaks and you see the sort of situations that they're living in, Your personal experience begins to speak really loud in that moment, and doubts begin to creep in. If you're wrestling with doubt, let me give you some application here. The most biblical and faithful thing you can do is to talk about it, is to do what Habakkuk does, is to bring it to God, is to bring it in light with him. Complaining, whatever, to bring it to God. You can also bring it in light with your community, to talk about it with those around you, to walk in the light. So the nature of doubt is that it's real. Our doubts are real and personal. So what are we to do with our doubt? Like, how do we, like Habakkuk, get through our doubt and respond with worship and devotion to God? Well, God, I think, gives us an answer in chapter 2, starting in verse 2. Listen to this. He says, so Habakkuk has just brought his second complaint to God, and he says, I'm going to go up in my watchtower. I'm going to wait there for your answer. And then the Lord answers him, and he says, write this vision. Make it plain on tablets so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. And here it comes. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But the righteous shall live by faith. The answer that God gives us here in Habakkuk, the way through our doubts, the model and the answer that we have is to walk by faith. In Habakkuk's second complaint that he brings to God, he is essentially saying, okay, so look, the Babylonians are going to come and destroy Judah. That's what you just said, God. Right, that doesn't make any sense to me, but if that's going to happen, right, what am I supposed to do now? You've called me to be a prophet to these people, and so you've called me to call them to repentance. So what am I supposed to do now? And God says, look, tell them this, Habakkuk, the righteous will live by faith. In the midst of this pain and destruction and suffering that is coming upon you, my people will be my people by living by faith. So what does it mean then to live by faith in the midst of our doubt? I want to show you four things from Habakkuk that I think we learn a little bit of insight about this. Four things. The first one is this. Living by faith in the midst of doubt requires patience. It requires patience. Verse 3, God says, he says this vision is coming, and he says, for still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. We must patiently wait on the Lord. Look, and you know exactly what this means. It means we don't give up. It means when things go wrong, when life seems unfair, when you're in the middle of pain and suffering, living by faith means that you patiently wait on the Lord in the midst of your circumstances. Now, the thing about patience, as you well know, is that it doesn't just happen upon you, right? You don't just get patience. You don't just, like, pull it out of this bag, right? Patience comes, rather, as you humble yourself and acknowledge that I'm not all-important, I'm not all-knowing, I'm not all-wise. You have to work at it. You have to pursue it. You have to run after it. And here's the main mark of humble patience. Are you waiting patiently on God himself, or are you waiting on him to do something for you? Are you more interested in knowing God than in getting his answers? Humble patience means waiting on the person of God. It means waiting on God himself, not on his things. So the purpose of waiting on God then is to receive more of him, to receive a greater understanding of his character, a greater dependence on him, a deeper sense of joy in him. In other words, our patience, our waiting, must be God-centered. We wait on the person of God. One of the most practical ways that I see this play out in our lives is in making decisions. And we all have important decisions that we have to make from time to time. They creep up. We've got to go right. We've got to go left. Am I going to take this job, that job? Am I going to move? You know, all on and on it goes. And you all have these times in your life when making a decision just seems, it's really hard sometimes. You seek counsel. You get wisdom from other people. You weigh all the pros and cons. You pray for direction and clarity from God, right? But it's still really hard to figure out what it is that God wants you to do. But what I've learned and what I want to suggest to you is that in the midst of making decisions, we need a mind shift. We need a change. Right? My concern primarily should not be, right, that I'm not primarily concerned what God primarily doesn't want from me. He's not seeking to give me answers. He's seeking to give me more of himself. And so as we seek to make decisions, what would it look like to pursue a deeper sense of reliance and trust and dependence on God over and above getting an answer, getting direction, getting clarity? Now, when you face doubts, if you meet them with patience, it will produce character in you. Patience makes you into the kind of person who is able to live by faith and get through your doubts. Living by faith in the midst of doubt requires patience. That's the first thing. Second, living by faith in the midst of doubt requires perspective. At the end of Habakkuk's second complaint, what does he do? Right. He says that he's going to go up into the watchtower, he's going to look out over things, and he's going to wait for God. Right. A watchtower is a measure of defense that will allow you to get really high so that you could look out over all the land and you could gain perspective. Right, so if an enemy was coming, you would have the perspective to see them, to see what you were up against. Right, without that perspective, you wouldn't see what was coming until it was too late. And what that means for us is that spiritually, we must take our problems and doubt and put them in perspective of God's full revelation. We can't just get so focused minutely on our problems. We must take our eyes off of ourselves and put them in the perspective of everything that God tells us in his word. And this is exactly what we see Habakkuk doing. He begins in chapter 3, he begins rehearsing and meditating on God's glory and his goodness. Chapter 3 is this prayer, or better yet, it's a song that Habakkuk has written. And in it, Habakkuk he's singing about what he knows about God and his glory and how he has acted throughout history. Listen to just a little bit of this. O Lord, I have heard the report of you. And your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Taman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. His rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and he measured the earth, and he looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers or your indignation against the sea when you rode on horses, on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flashing of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea, with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. I would love to know what the melody was to that song. Habakkuk here is praising God for who he is. He's remembering what it is that God has done and how he has acted throughout history. Parts of the verses that I just read are referencing the Exodus and other places where God delivered his people and brought salvation to his people. You see what he's doing? He is rehearsing, he's turning over, he's meditating on God's goodness. And it's giving him grand perspective. Living by faith in the midst of doubt requires humble patience. It also requires perspective. Third, living by faith in the midst of doubt requires obedience. Habakkuk says that he's going to go into the tower and he's going to remain there until he hears from God. Right? This is a picture of his obedience, even in the midst of his doubts about what God is doing. You see, a watchman never abandons his post, no matter what is going on. It doesn't matter what is going on around him, his circumstances, all heck could be breaking loose. He can't leave his post. Right? He must remain obedient. No matter the doubt or the pain that we are going through, we must be obedient to what God has called us to. This means that we must do the things that God has called us to. Right? We read our Bible, we pray, we gather with his people. These are things that he has called all of us to. There are also specific things on your life, on my life, that God has called me to. I do those things as well. I remain obedient to the things that God has called me to. This also means that we refrain from the things that God has called us to refrain from. In times when you feel weary, when you feel disappointed, when you feel distant from God, isn't it true that it becomes very tempting to run to things for momentary relief and pleasure? You just want to feel good. And so you do things with sex, with money, with food. You just need some relief, and it doesn't seem like God is bringing it to you in the moment. And so you run to things for a quick fix. And it makes you feel better for a moment. But I think you know that in the end, it leaves you feeling worse than before. Living by faith in times of doubt and pain means being obedient even when you're weary and hurting. You do the next thing that God is calling you to. You put one foot in front of the other. Living by faith in the midst of doubt requires obedience. And then the last thing, the fourth thing, living by faith in the midst of doubt requires rejoicing. And just like patience, joy is not the sort of thing that you can just pull out of your bag whenever you want. Right? But Habakkuk shows us that you can cultivate it in your life. You see, Habakkuk waited patiently on God. He gained perspective on his circumstances. He was obedient to God's calling. And it moved him to joyful worship. Listen again to the very end of this book. Listen to the way he responds with joy for his God. He says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. When he says that God makes his feet like the deer to tread on high places, he's talking about like a mountain deer, a deer that has these special hooves that allow him to get around in the mountains. A mountain is a rocky, it's a treacherous place, it's really dangerous to get around. But not for the mountain deer, right? His footing is sure. And Habakkuk says that so is the person who lives by faith. That person is able to rejoice in the Lord no matter their circumstances. We live by faith in the midst of doubt by waiting patiently, by gaining perspective, by walking in obedience, and by rejoicing in God's power and in his goodness. And like Habakkuk, we will be able to worship God no matter our circumstances. But there's one more thing. You see, we actually, all of you here today, we have a leg up on Habakkuk. When God said that the righteous will live by faith, we now have access to the full revelation of what he meant by that. In Romans 1, Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation from faith to faith, because as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." The righteous shall live by faith means that God's people must live by faith. Right? We must be faithful no matter our circumstances. We just got done talking about that. But it also means that the righteous, God's people, are made righteous. They are given life and salvation only through faith in Jesus. Grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. That's the gospel. And Paul says that it's this gospel that is the power to live by faith. The fullness of God's revelation to Habakkuk is that the righteous shall live by faith, in that the power to actually live by faith comes through the righteousness of Christ. That's our only hope. In the greatest act of injustice and evil ever, Jesus, the innocent one, he was crucified for us. We are the benefactors of the greatest act of evil and injustice ever. I know you've heard this before, but listen to me. We are the people that Habakkuk was describing. We are the unrighteous. We are the wicked, the deserving of judgment, having instead received life and blessing and righteousness from God through Christ. The gospel gives us the ultimate answer to getting through our doubts and suffering. It's that God suffers the ultimate evil himself in order to defeat and undo evil, when everything sad will become untrue. Look, the only way to get through the loss of a child, your firstborn, the only way to get through that kind of pain and to respond with joy is to realize that God sympathizes with our weaknesses. He is acquainted with grief and sorrow. God gave up his only son, the firstborn of all creation, in order to redeem us from the curse and the brokenness of this world. Jesus perfectly walked through these steps we just talked about. It says that he endured the cross, right? He patiently endured the cross. And he endured it for the joy set before him, meaning he had perspective about what God was doing. He cried out in the garden. He cried to his father. He says, "If there's any other way for this to go down, please take this cup from me." God said, "There's not." And so Jesus walked. He submitted his will to the Father in perfect obedience. And on the cross, as he was being crucified, he cried out, "It is finished," rejoicing. God, through his son Jesus, has entered into suffering, not just to be with us in our pain, but to redeem us and enable us to rejoice in him. This gospel is the greatest power that we have against doubt. We meditate on Jesus. We rejoice in him. Join me in prayer.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.